Episode 82, Patrick and Cyprian celebrate 3 years of Entangled Things. The team discuss the different modalities, shifting perspectives, and the importance of the algorithms. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how you doing?
Hey, Patrick. I'm doing well, and I'm looking forward for this special episode of Entangled Things.
Yes, so it's been long, but it really has flown by. It's been 3 years. This is our third year of doing this. And I remember 5 years ago or more, we were like, it'd be cool if we did a podcast. And then we're both like, yeah, that's going to be hard. But we got a great support staff and, you know, and Aaron and Jill that make it happen. So you and I basically just show up. So we've come a long way, but there's some things that really haven't changed that much. We're still not seeing headlines of quantum changing the world. But behind the scenes, I think we've made progress. What do you think?
I think it's I would dare to say almost exactly as I was imagining it, right? It's difficult. It's hard. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of talent. It takes a lot of effort. And when these things are required, nothing happens quickly.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised and I'm not disappointed, right?
It's compared to fusion a lot. Because it's, you know, billions and billions of dollars. No one puts one of these together by, you know, taking apart their toaster.
Yeah, but then again, the promise, right, or the opportunity,
yeah,
is, I think it's worth any kind of effort, any kind of money, any kind of investment.
Well, the big change that I see in the 3 years is that we're now talking about thousands and millions of qubits with a straight face, without, like, you know, fairy tale ideas. We have companies that actually that is their mission, is to get a billion qubits on the table. Not a billion, a million. And that seems to be the break point now. That seems to be our vision where we could actually get some stuff done.
I fully agree. And I think that's exactly what is happening. The other thing that I see also happening is we start to understand better the limitations, the challenges, the problems, right? Especially in the various modalities of building the quantum computers. And I would even say we acknowledge them with, let's say, more openness, right? We're like, hey, yeah, we know this is the problem. Hey, we know this is the limitation, right? We accept those limitations and try to find solutions. So it's almost like we're slowly getting into a different level of maturity.
Beginning or the middle of the beginning.
Something like that, yeah.
Do some things. And we've had a lot of fantastic guests. I wouldn't want to, single out anything, but we've had people from academia. We've had corporate business leaders, people who are educating the youth of tomorrow. I think we're both still enamored of the idea of teaching high school kids to be quantum first. That now we're not quite at the quantum first generation that you envision. That's probably more like your kids and my grandkids, not the kids in high school right now. There's been a lot of sites that have come out trying to educate people, but we seem to have moved beyond the basics of, well, this is superposition. That's still there. But we're seeing more about learning how to actually use this stuff in things that Microsoft and others have done.
Yeah. I think we have more abstractions on top of the basics, right? And to your point, Patrick, I think it's also becoming increasingly easier to learn this thing. I'm mentioning this just because it's fresh in the back of my mind, right? Our guest from Microsoft that announced that the katas are available directly on the website, right? You don't need to set up anything. You don't need to. Everything is there. You just go to a website, right?
That wasn't that long ago. And that's that. Yeah. They're lowering the barriers to entry. I mean, I know how to set up a VM, and I still sometimes won't.
Yeah.
just because of the time commitment.
Yeah. And it's not an easy thing, right? But now you're basically, if you're even, let's say, a young or a very young person, you're not that tech savvy yet, right? And you want to start learning about this, it's easy. And it's obviously not only Microsoft, right? There are many others who are doing this. So I think this is also an important step, right? It becomes easier to learn about these things. It becomes easier to play with the different languages and the different simulators out there. And I think that is an important step forward.
So when we first started talking about this, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the math, and a lot of time trying to understand the geometry and the imaginary numbers and on all those things. And I think you're right. I think we're getting to a point where a lot of that stuff is becoming abstracted, which is a good thing. It'll mean that a lot more people can approach this stuff. A lot more people can make use of this stuff. I don't know where we'll be in another 3 years. Dare we predict where 3 years from now? I love predictions. They're very risky, though.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, right? Because, and again, I'm just coming back to the Microsoft examples because they're fresh in the back of my mind, right? Remember what happened in 2018, right?
With the
announcement of the Majorana fermion, right? And then how it took more than or almost 4 years to actually get back. And
we got in a space where Microsoft wouldn't talk about quantum for a number of years. Yeah. And we're just emerging from that blackout period in the last year.
I think to a point that's also part of the process, right? Every black eye that you get with one of these things, right, is at the end of the day proves to be a step forward.
That's true.
I would not honestly venture into making a prediction. I would rather state a wish, right? And my wish would be that in 3 years from now, we could talk about at least one significant breakthrough in the modalities for building quantum computers, right? I honestly don't really care which one or which ones would they be, but I would really, really be happy to be in a position where in 2026, we're going to talk about, hey, Patrick, remember what happened on our fifth anniversary or on our fourth anniversary,
right? Yeah.
When they discovered this amazing thing that kind of jump-started or rebooted the whole discussion on building quantum computers.
So if we talk about like IBM, they had an early lead with superconducting, and they did a lot with, you know, adding more chips. I think, first 40 and then, first they started with much less, but they seem to be ahead of everybody. But then as their chips were released, we really haven't heard a lot about them being used for things other than research. And so I think that's the bottleneck that we need to break. Is that what you're talking about? Or are you thinking more about like nitrogen vacancies in diamond becoming easier to manipulate at room temperature, or the Majorana fermion that Microsoft's trying to pursue becoming a real boy, as they say?
Yeah, I always look at this from two perspectives, right? Like, I wish there could be a breakthrough in the, should I dare, classical types of modalities, like trapped ions, right? And the others that are, as I said, you could almost name them as being classical.
They're almost mainstream now.
Yeah.
Superconducting, trapped ions. Yeah. But they're because there's implementations of them. Therefore, they're more real.
As we did implementation, as you mentioned, IBM, right? We also became painfully aware of their limitations, right?
Yeah.
Especially around the topologies required to build 2-qubit gates, right? The possibilities of using pairs of qubits, right, to build 2-qubit gates, and those are real problems. So, on one hand, I wish we see a breakthrough there, and then on the other hand, I would wish not necessarily for a breakthrough, but for a speed up in, like, let's say, the alternatives, like nitrogen vacancies or the Majorana zero modes that Microsoft is researching. It would be great either way. In an ideal world, it would be both, but at least if one of them happens, I'd be more than happy.
Right. Yeah. So you're looking for a bit of a shakeup in the thing. I think we can count on a steady movement ahead for the superconducting and the trapped ion crowd. And of course, I haven't heard much about D-Wave as far as like newer, bigger systems. I know they're probably still very far ahead, but we probably do overdue to talk to them again. What about the adiabatic side? Is it really just going to be D-Wave? I really by this time expected someone else to join the fray, but they've had some financial problems in the past. So maybe people are waiting to see how they shake that out. But that seems to be where people are actually doing real work.
Agreed. Yeah. And if you look at D-Wave specifically, right, you see like a sharp decline roughly between like May 2022 all the way to maybe May 2023. And then they seem to be relatively steady, right, in terms of how they are perceived. However, it could very well be that things are not working out that well for adiabatic quantum computing. I kind of second what you say. I was trying to see like the other D-Waves of the world, right? The other approaches that are similar there. And it just seems that it's, you know, when we were first thinking about adiabatic quantum computing, it almost felt like, hey, this is stuff that can create more qubits, granted, not like full qubits, so to speak, right? But more qubits, so it will probably be able to make some strides into their specific areas of focus, like optimization. Yet, I don't see too much of that. Maybe we're not looking in the right place, Patrick, right? That could also be the cause.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought of adiabatic as a shortcut, a way for us to get something faster, to get to computing faster and actually solving real world problems. And we have Elisabetta and other people on the show who've talked about using Kubos and actually doing calculations and doing optimizations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be where they were going. The question is whether they just ran out of runway, where it ran out of space for people to solve big problems, or it's just a natural, you know, ebb and flow of the industry, and then they'll be back like gangbusters this coming year.
And there's one other thing that was on the back of my mind, and that is like I'm starting to have some doubts about the fact that startups are a good fit for this world. And that's because I'm looking at multiple startups, and all of them, like D-Wave included, right? They exhibit like a big, big drop in their market capitalization. And in a world where this progress does not come overnight, right, where the pressure of the delivering things quarter over quarter, like is immense.
Yeah.
I start to see a lot of the startups, I mean the high profile startups for sure, right?
Yeah.
Struggling. While I see the big players kind of marching on, right?
The IBMs and Honeywells.
Yeah, right. It almost feels like you need to be the IBMs, the Microsofts, the Honeywells, the Intels of the world, right? To survive this early stage of attempting to make quantum computing a thing, right? And again, I just to be very clear, I'm not minimizing or downplaying in any way the role of startups, the contribution,
no.
But I'm just looking at numbers, right?
Yeah,
whether they're not doing well
for them.
Yeah, they're not doing well at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, well, I mean, we see this in every industry, whether it's oil and gas or
sure.
computer programming. A lot of times it's the small companies that figure out the path, and many of them die along the way. And when they find out a path, they get absorbed very quickly by a major.
Exactly.
And then, you know, it gets scaled. It gets scaled out. We're seeing that in the gas and oil industry in the United States, though that's probably a bit far afield to divert to. And so maybe this is part of the the process. These small companies want to become the big companies.
Yep.
As we, you know, we certainly understand. And some of them have been a success. D-Wave, I don't know that they're, I mean, I've seen their founder speak. I don't know that they had, you know, billions of dollars behind them. I think they started out what we would consider bootstrap in this industry. And certainly, you know, seeing Microsoft playing and IBM playing is that's where the majors are. But I think you're right. I think we'll see some consolidations in the industry as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a really, the guests really have made a big difference in the way I understand things. There's been lots of really insights over the years. One of the things that sticks out, maybe it shouldn't, is the idea of having hollow fiber optic cables. I never thought of that, but that in order to keep the coherence of a photon, you need to keep it inside the cable. Little things like that kind of compound. And so we've been really lucky. We've been able to learn about something we're very interested in by interviewing people who we look up to in almost all cases. I think that in some cases they've given us insights into where they're trying to bring the industry. But overall, it's just that march forward and error correcting and error correcting and error correcting seems to be the theme. If I had to pick one thing over the 3 years, we've probably mentioned error correction off the cuff more often than anything else. Sisyphean effort? Are we going to be doing this forever? Because it feels like we roll the rock up and then it just keeps rolling back down. When we've made progress, it seems, but we might now need to look back for 3 years to see that progress.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, right? If it wasn't difficult, we would have probably had quantum computing a long time ago.
Yeah.
But getting back to the guests, right? One thing that really inspires me and I love is every single one of them is so passionate and so enthusiastic, right? About the various things that they're doing, right? Despite the immense kind of hurdles, despite the immense kind of mountains that we need to pass, right? To paraphrase what you are saying, I still see, and it's probably one of the things that drives me, right? To continue doing this podcast, I continue to see optimism and I continue to see determination, right? In solving the problems, in addressing the hard, things, the hard steps they need to follow on their path. This is really, really inspiring for me.
Yeah, it feels like the mission to Mars almost. There's just, you knock down a problem, there's another, you know, another mountain range behind.
Exactly. And I was reflecting upon this a little bit. Like, every now and then I tend to kind of question myself with the hard questions. And one of these hard questions was like, hey, Cyprian, like, you really still enjoy doing Entangle things, right? Is this still kind of, you know, driving you? And the answer is an absolute and resounding yes.
Yeah.
Right? Even if we have like 3 years behind us, right? Every time we discuss with someone, every new perspective, every new idea, right? In itself is amazing, right? And it feels so good to be connected with people that are making things happen, right? That's probably one of the best thing that happened to me, at least in Entangle things.
Yeah, we didn't really have a vision for how we were going to do the podcast when we started, because we were going to, like, if it was just you and I lecturing, I think we would have bored ourselves to death long ago, because it's a big topic. There's lots to talk about, but having the other voices, having the other perspectives, Bob Kowak talking to us when we first came on, I don't think it was in the last year, it was a year before, about language and the ability to use quantum to do language processing because it matched up so well. And that was the result of him talking to a linguist and trying to convince, you know, trying to talk to them about quantum, and the linguist saying, well, that's exactly the way we think about vocabularies and lexicons, and, yep, and seeing that synergy. And so I like to think that by doing the podcast with guests instead of just you and I off the top of our head like we are in this episode, it's actually added quite a bit. It's made it far more interesting for me. I think it's made it more interesting to you. Not that I don't like talking to you, but I think, you know, an hour every 2 weeks, we'd run out of things to say. We still do try to do episodes with just you and I to kind of refresh a topic or revisit for the people who are just joining. But the guests have really made the big difference. But I have to confess, that wasn't my model when we first started.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and to be very honest, like historically speaking, right? Remember, we were in the beginning, we were quite surprised when we were actually just simply getting the guests, right?
Yes. Why would they talk to us?
right. again, and I think, like, looking back at these 3 years, either, like, whether it was intentional or not, that's a topic for a different discussion. But I think we managed to kind of, you know, hit the right notes,
yeah,
and make this thing both interesting and comfortable for a wide variety of people involved in the space of quantum to discuss all sorts of things with us, right? I think we've managed to make Entangle Things a place where folks who are working really hard to solve really hard problems in quantum feel on one side welcome, right? And on the other side, right, they feel comfortable discussing things with us. And that's maybe because, Patrick, none of us, right, is earning a living out of
we're not a competitor. We're not in the space in that way.
We don't have an agenda.
Which you'd think would hurt us because, you know, we're not really there. We're not in their crowd, but it's actually been very helpful because we represent who they're trying to communicate with.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's been good.
Exactly. Right. And the other thing that I was kind of like reflecting upon is the fact that we had our fair share of very interesting announcements going through. Yeah. Our podcast, right? That was another angle that I really love. When people started perceiving us as a voice in this community, that feels great, to be very honest, right? Just
knowing a channel of
exactly.
Well, when we look at other podcasts in this space, there a lot of them are not very long lived. We've seen a lot of podcasts. When we first started, I went looking and there were a lot of quantum podcasts that did an episode, two episodes in the first week, and then an episode a month, and then an episode every 3 months, and then an episode every, you know, and then they just peter off. One of our secrets, I think, has been the ability for us to actually continue. And that's the shout out to Aaron and Jill. More than anything
100%,
else.
100%.
You know, you and I have the luxury of showing up and getting this done, and they, you know, they pull it all together, organize the guests. And that, can't thank them enough. If they weren't so shy, I'd have them. We should have them as guests sometimes to see what they
would be awesome. Like, I would really love, you know, to have a chat with Jill and Aaron and hear what they have learned from this podcast, right? On both a personal level as well.
I don't know if I want to hear some of that. That might be dangerous.
I don't know. It could be fun, though.
No, right? I'm sure it would be great. I'm sure it would be great. We'll have to talk to them about it. So the idea of having a consistent podcast. Now we're in the 20,000s of listens. I won't you know overhype it. We probably get a few. What do we get? We get a few hundred listeners per episode, but because we have so many episodes, we're in the 20,000s now of downloads and listens. And I'm sure some of that is a lot of people who listen to many episodes, which is great as well. But we've probably also moved the needle in just getting education, because we've had at least two episodes so far where we've talked about superposition and a couple of episodes where we've covered entanglement from start to finish. And so we're trying to also do our part for like getting the word out. And if I had to pick the mission for the podcast, the first mission, the secret mission is to keep up with it, to stay smart on it, because it's definitely done that. I feel much better informed on quantum computing than I ever could just reading articles on my own, because ask questions. The other side of it, though, is to bring this to the masses, to help people understand what this technology is, what it can do, and to not run screaming from the room when someone brings it up. One of the biggest misnomers seems to be that it's a competitor to classical computing, and we've resoundly put that down. But that seems to be something that has to be brought front and center when someone's first learning about this. It isn't the next level of computing; it's the next layer of computing that's going to augment what we already have.
And it's not going to. Exactly. It's not going to replace classical computing.
No.
It's going to be able to solve those problems that classical computing struggles with, right? That's where I see quantum computing. To be very honest with you, I have a hard time imagining quantum phones and quantum laptops and quantum fridges or quantum vacuum cleaners, right?
There's no room there. There's no problem. For that.
Exactly. And this brings, I think, up one of the things that we've had as a recurring theme in many of our episodes, which is framing the problem the right way for quantum. It turns out to be one of the very, very difficult things to do. Even if you have the quantum computer, even if the quantum computer works, if error correction works, right? We've learned that it's not easy to frame problems so that they're suited or suitable for being run or being addressed by quantum computers. That's a distinct field of research, right? Which is pretty hot these days, because we're starting to understand more and more about the importance of framing the problem in the right way. And then to your point about classical versus quantum, right? It's remarkable the level of hybrid efforts that we see out there. The intent to bridge these two worlds, right? To get them as close as possible so we can literally switch between classical code and quantum code back and forth. Actually, I think this is one of the big directions, and I think it holds one of the big promises for the next decade, the hybrid computing model.
So when you say that, I kind of got a roadblock in my mind. All quantum computing seems to be hybrid because there's very few things, even if you take Shor's algorithm, for example, Shor's algorithm doesn't solve the problem of factoring. It gives you a hint. And it's a hint that then you take to a classical computer and you bring it the rest of the way very quickly. So I've always thought of it as, once I understood it, that it's always got to be a team up between quantum providing the go in this direction, or, you know, you're getting hot, you're getting cold kind of thing. And the classical computer takes it the rest of the way. When you talk about the mode of hybrid, how is that different? Is that different because we're no longer looking for the magic bullet that can all be done in quantum? which seem to be the beginning of things.
Yes, it is more like, honestly, the physical distance between the classical and the quantum environment and code, right? Because from an algorithmic perspective, right, we're living clearly in a hybrid world, right? We're solving with quantum algorithms parts of classical algorithms, where I think that the real value of hybrid quantum computing lies is when you try to materialize this in actual systems, right? How difficult is from a physical perspective to switch from the point of your problem where the classical code ends its role and the quantum starts? How difficult is to move the information between the two systems, right? Because at the end of the day, classical will set up a problem for quantum. Quantum will provide a solution for classical, right? So it's more like at the physical level where I'm envisioning it, I see hybrid quantum computing, right? Making it, for instance, significantly more easier to incorporate an order finding module, right, into a classical computing system, or a Grover search or Grover iteration module, or a quantum Fourier transformation module, right? And things like that. It's really at that level that I'm thinking about it.
So we're kind of running low on time, but I did want to approach one more thing, which is the surprise I think we both have, though I don't want to put words in your mouth, for the fact that we're still talking about those same two algorithms. So I bring up Shor's, you bring up Grover's, and I've kind of come to the realization that we may not have a bunch of other algorithms developed that change the world. And we've had some discussions with, I can't remember who it was, in that first year where they talked about there just not being that many NP problems or, you know, hard enough problems that we need quantum to solve. And that seems to have borne out. We haven't seen, I thought we would start seeing other named algorithms in the universal quantum computing space that would change things, and it just hasn't borne out. It hasn't happened. Is that a big surprise for you?
No, I think it's kind of linked to the speed at which the actual computers are being developed. If you think at the history of classical computing algorithms, you will see that there were spikes in the evolution and things like that. But at the end of the day, right, we did not invent deep neural networks before we created the transistor chip, right? Although from a purely theoretical point of view, right, one could think that, hey, you don't need a working classical computer to imagine a deep neural network. The thing is, nobody did, because there was no trigger for that imagination, right? Only when we started having GPU cores in the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, folks started to think like, hey, what if this good old neural network could be transformed into a huge neural network?
Right.
Huge in like 170 billion parameters neural network. And I think this is pretty much that what we see and will see quantum computing as well, right? The two are kind of fueling each other. And I think for now, to be honest, the algorithms have done their part, because if it were not for Shor and Grover and the others, but mostly for Shor, right? Yeah. I think the level of interest that we have today in quantum computing would have been significantly lower. So we don't have too many algorithms, but the ones that we have are really something.
Yeah. I credit Shor's as the reason that there's so much money continuously pouring into this. There really hasn't been a lull in the money side of things. And why is that? Well, it's probably because the governments are so interested in this for global competition. Everyone's afraid that someone else is going to get Shor's working, and then they're going to be able to decrypt all the different, you know, secrets of other countries. And so it's that kind of fear of missing out. Let's call it, you know, governmental FOMO,
mm-hmm.
right? That's yep, driven yep. a lot of the money. Though
sure,
that hasn't been
sure.
our predominant, you know, conversations with our guests. Our guests have talked more about, you know, the education side and the optimization side. We really haven't gotten too many talks about, you know, the doom and gloom scenarios of shores.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on who you are talking to, and I would even say when you are talking to certain people, right? I think what we see is when we specifically talk about shore, right? People are becoming increasingly aware of multiple security-related threats, not only quantum ones. And what I really like, for example, is the whole discussion and debate and process around post-quantum security,
mm-hmm.
Cryptography, right? Where people realized, hey, yes, okay, Shor is going to potentially break RSA, and it's going to break the way we do things. So let's start kind of reigniting the innovation process in that space, and let's identify or let's develop right approaches that are going to be safe or safer right in front of the huge capacity and power of quantum computers. So it's something that quantum computing does without even needing to exist, right?
Right.
And I think it's a tangible improvement. Like, you clearly know a whole lot more about the topic than I do. But my kind of outsider view is that this has really benefited, right, the world of cryptography, the world of encryption, the world of hashing, and so forth.
You've sat through most of my talks. You probably know everything I know about this stuff. So I think we'll have to leave it there until next year, but hopefully we don't wait that long to listen to the next episode of Entangled Things. As always, thanks for being on this journey with me, Cyprian. It's been great so far, and hopefully we can keep up the quality of guests. It's blown me away.
Oh, absolutely, and it goes without saying, the feeling is absolutely mutual, Patrick. Like, it's always such a great experience. Being with you and doing Entangled Things, and of course my thanks and my appreciations go out to Jill and Aaron, and last but not least to our guests and our viewers, right, who are really the ones that are like keeping the flame burning here.
And if it was really just if it was just my mother listening to it, I'm not sure I'd have the will to go on. So.
So that makes me at least like really looking forward for our fourth anniversary.
There you go. I look forward to it. Well, thanks to everybody. We'll see you next time on Entangled Things.
Thank you. See you.